Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I am your host, Jason Napolitano, and on the phone, as usual, we have co-host Chris Sheridan. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Jason. Good to be here.
Great to have you here. We are speaking again this week on the Ancient Mysteries and Secret Societies, and this is part three of that series of talks. It's going to be Roman numeral four, or IV, if you don't know Roman numerals, in the big Manly Hall book. In the small one, if you have the Penguin book and you're following along, that is page 67 in that one. And as I said, I'm your host, Jason Napolitano. I am the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. And Chris is the author of The Spirit in the Sky, and both of those books are available for sale now. So please support us and keep this this podcast on if you dig what we're doing by buying our books and checking out our websites. I am at cosmiceye.org, C-O-S-M-I-C.org, and Chris is at chrissheridan.com, C-H-R-I-S-S-H-E-R-I-D-A-N.com. So there's our standard plug every week that we like to share. In addition, please go ahead and rate us or review us on iTunes. That helps a great deal to get more listeners and for people to know that we're here. And you can give us some feedback about what you like, what you don't like, what you'd like to see more of, or hit us up here on Anchor at anchor.fm. There's a link where you can actually send in questions. You can leave a recording. And we would love to hear from you. If there's something you want to hear or something in one of the podcasts you didn't understand or you want to go deeper into, please go ahead and hit us up and we would love to interact with you. So let's go ahead and get into this. We're going to first kind of set this up. We talked about this a little bit before the show. And Chris and I wanted to bring up the point that, you know, it's important sometimes to take a look at what we're studying, why we're studying it. You know, it's fun to go into this material. It is neat material, and it's interesting. And, you know, there's a lot of attraction to it if you're interested in the esoteric or occult or the hidden history, Illuminati, all of these sorts of things, Freemasonry. It's all very, very interesting. But in the end, you know, there also has to be a payoff personally. And so I wanted to kind of get into a couple ideas, and Chris wanted to share some stuff as well about why we're working on this stuff, why the secret teachings and why Manly Hall, and in particular, but in general, you know, why we do this work, this philosophical or spiritual work at all. You know, and one thing I will always go back to when looking at Manly Hall's work, especially in secret teachings, the very first chapter, the very first thing Manly Hall says is philosophy is the science of estimating values. And what I get out of that is that philosophy teaches you to estimate what is valuable in life. It helps you to, you know, to sort of discern the wheat from the chaff, as it were, the good from the not so good, the helpful from the unhelpful, and so on. And so I think that's one of the most valuable things, is being able to develop a philosophy for life whereby you can go after the good, the beautiful, the true, and all of those philosophical principles. By developing, you know, a way of estimating values, like what is valuable in my life, what do I find valuable, ultimately speaking, and things like that. Do you want to comment on that a little bit?
Well, you have to, even before you rate something as whether it's valuable or not, you have to really kind of see it for what it is. And again, that's another one of the reasons for having a spiritual or philosophic plan of study, is that you are looking at things maybe for what they really are, and then it becomes more apparent, or then you have more information from which to make a judgment whether this is something I value. For example, you know, society and everything else tells us that, you know, looking a certain way or having a certain thing or income or a car, that these things are valuable, and they have some value, but if we look at those things as being, oh gosh, almighty important, then we're not going to see the value. What good is spiritual abundance if I don't have abundance in my pocketbook? You know, you're not going to even see that as value. But if you can learn about these things, Manly Hall believe the world is a school and we're here to learn. And we all learn at different levels. It's a big one-room schoolhouse. But if we can learn about these things and maybe uncover some of these truths, have an experience with these spiritual values, that maybe then they would become more valuable. So it's training the mind to be able to see what is valuable. And then it becomes a matter of determining, yes, and that discernment on what is helpful in my life.
That's a very, very good point. Very succinctly put. Thank you, my friend. It reminds me of the little plaque that was above the doorway before you would head into the Delphic Oracle. And it's, you know, that famous statement, know thyself, know thyself. And I think that really these philosophical and spiritual studies are tools to learn more about yourself. What are you about? What do you value? Where do you come from? What is your true substance or nature? Are you just a body, you know, that, you know, when it goes to death, disintegrates and that's that? Or is there something more? Is there a soul? Is there a spirit? You know, delving into that and getting to know those truths for yourself, I think is one of the goals of philosophy, in essence. And you're right, is school, you know, this is a school for us to learn. So at any rate, I just wanted to kind of get into that before we got into what we were talking about today, which is, again, the Ancient Mysteries and Secret Societies, part 3 of Manly Hall's Secret Teachings of All Ages, a fantastic book that you must buy. It is a must own. And, you know,
and remember, it's an encyclopedic outline. It's not even an encyclopedia. it's so condensed that it's just an encyclopedic outline. But that said, it's very, very dense, very, very compact. Every sentence is, you know, could be a paragraph or a page. It's very, very,
yeah,
very loaded. And it requires unpacking and looking maybe more deeply, or looking at other sources. So we can't cover, you know, 3 different secret societies in you know, 40 minutes or something, nor could he in a few pages.
Exactly.
But he really got the more, you know, relevant and important aspects of it. But, you know, you can read them and they do stand on their own. Even if you know nothing about them, you will know more by reading through these things. But it's also an opportunity to go deeper into
exactly.
these traditions. And he leaves references
authors. That's a very good point as well. And, you know, really all we can do in these short sessions is kind of point out some of the things that we think are interesting, some of the things that catch our eye. But we really encourage you to read these chapters yourself and wrestle with them and go through and mark out what you think is important and think about how those ideas affect you in your own life. So that's one of the ways to really grapple with this material and really make it come alive for yourself, you know, and listen to us. And, you know, hopefully we can give, you know, some of the wisdom or little bits of knowledge that we've gained over the years in studying this material. You know, Chris, you were at PRS for how many years? 12 years or?
12 years. Officially.
And you have your degree from there as well. You have a master's degree in spiritual psychology from, University of Philosophical Research, which is a huge honor, and you're one of few people that have that. And you know, I was there for like 2 years, I think, but I studied there for many years, and that's where Chris and I actually met at the Philosophical Research Society, which is Manly Hall's foundation that he created. And you know, I think you know, we have pretty good insight into this book, but we're learning as well. You know, what can I say? We're all on this learning journey, right? And we are ostensibly teaching this material, but we're also learning as we go. And that's the beauty of it. So, all right, so let's get into this. So like the 3 groups that he really talks about in this chapter are the Eleusinian mysteries. Then he gets into the Orphic mysteries, the mysteries of Orpheus. And then, of course, follows it up with Dionysus and Bacchus. And really, the bulk of the information and the bulk of the important material is centered on the Eleusinian mysteries. And it seems that he feels, and I think a lot of people feel this way that have done research into these ancient mystery schools, that the Eleusinian mysteries were probably the most important and far reaching of the mysteries, and ended up really influencing much of what came after. And that's really what he's trying to lay out in these chapters to come. You see the kind of trajectory of this thought and symbolism through the mythology and through the rites and rituals of these different groups and schools. But the Eleusinian mystery schools were one of the most famous. He says the most famous of the ancient religious mysteries were the Eleusinian, whose rites were celebrated every 5 years in the city of Eleusis to honor Demeter or Ceres and her daughter Persephone. When he speaks of those 5 years, that's the greater mysteries. Then the lesser mysteries, of course, were celebrated every year. So at any rate, he goes on to point out how those mysteries spread out even into Roman Britain, and that they encompass a lot of other groups' work, who, in a sense, almost like the Christian church that enfolded a lot of pagan faiths and so forth, and those beliefs. The Eleusinian mysteries were sort of the forerunner of that.
Well, he mentions they go back perhaps 1,400 years before the Christian era, which is about 1,000 years before Socrates and Plato, around the time maybe of Moses, if that's, you know, if we can put a timeline on it.
Good point.
So it's very, very old. And he also mentions that they survived through the beginning of the official Christian era in the fourth century. So there's almost 2,000 years, well, about 1,800 years right there, of it having a life before the Christian era and continued after. And also that it trickled in, it had spread out so much. That women and children were allowed in the
Yes, that was an important part.
Eleusis, which is, so its reach was probably, so to say that it was the most important one includes the fact that it was, it had a long time period, and it had a dispersion that maybe some of the other ones didn't have.
Yes,
either geographically and as well as, gender. That
inclusivity.
Women
inclusivity
and children
as well.
Would also...
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
No, I knew you were groping for that word. It was on the tip of my tongue. But very good point. And again, I mean, a lot of this stuff too is more feminine in its orientation, which is interesting. You know, you can see these early developments where the feminine is much more revered. It's much more important in the whole scope of religious understanding, and that of course kind of changed as time went on. I mean, early Christianity certainly was skewed more towards the patriarchy, as was Judaism. The feminine was important in those religions, but as time went on, particularly in later iterations of it, it kind of was sort of pushed down. And I think that's a great shame. And what's happening now today, I think, in a lot of ways in society, is that the feminine is being sort of resurrected, and in some ways, oftentimes when we're trying to balance something out, we may go further to that side of things so that we eventually come back to the center. So I think we're finding that, we're finding a balance again in society, and I think that's a fantastic thing. So, but the heart of this Eleusinian mystery is really this mythology with Ceres or Demeter, who was a daughter of Zeus and Rhea. And she was the goddess of growth and grain, growth of vegetation, sort of this mysterious evolution of life that flows out of death. And then Persephone symbolizes the new life itself springing forth out of the dead seed. She, of course, Persephone was the daughter of Demeter, and she was captured by Pluto and brought into the underworld. And so, you have this sort of vegetation symbolism, the living and dying. You've got the cycles of the season, things like that. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's an important part of the symbolism.
Well, continuing on, the seed does get planted in the underworld, in underground, so to speak, in order for it to you know, we bury things that are dead, but yeah, burying the seed is actually what then allows it to spring forth and bring new life. And this being taken or falling into the underworld, Persephone is the soul in the human being that gets wrapped up, that gets consumed by this material world. And again, even the material world, mater, you know, it's a feminine, you know, the earth, Mother Earth. It's again, this feminine symbolism that is the nurturer and bringer forth of all life, but it also takes the dead back into her womb, so to speak, afterwards. So this continues on, but this search that, you know, that is going on, you know, looking for, you know, her daughter. And so Ceres, the mother of Persephone, is on this quest to recapture, to reclaim what has been lost. And it's interesting that it's a daughter. You know, as we see later in some of these other ones, it's a male and a female, and it's the feminine, the masculine, that this is really all kind of feminine, except for maybe Pluto, but that it's this, you know, reclaiming this part of your heart, this part of your soul.
Yeah, well, the soul gets itself, actually, you know, because they later on go to liken it to the, you know, the idea of psyche, and psyche is another word for soul. So I think that's a good point.
And how many of us, and how many people do we know, even if they don't know it, that they've somehow sold their soul or just neglected it. Maybe sure. Lost it. So, well, yeah, I got to do this, but I got to work. Well, I have to cut my hair because I want to get well. Yeah, I know I'd really like to do this, but, and yes, we have to make compromises. We do have to do things to get by. We live in this world. But if it so much gets buried and time and space are removed from this heartstring that connects us with our soul, it becomes, you know, it becomes vital and very, very important to reclaim this. So this mystery is this drama that reminds us of that, that shows us, you know, that our soul can get enwrapped in matter, and that it is necessary, that it is needed to bring it back and bring it up from this underworld. I think in depth psychology, there's a notion of a Pluto crisis. That is, if there is some issue or something, your soul, your heartstrings, that have been neglected and pushed down, we tend to push these things away, even the good stuff we shove down in the shadow. But then at some point, Pluto will rise, that some crisis will happen in your life, maybe in your outer world, you know, firing from a job, divorce, different things. And then that creates this opening then that you have to go back. So the crisis is maybe a bad thing, but it's a call to action to go down and reclaim this and bring it back. And it's interesting how Ceres, when she's looking for and searching for her lost child, she carried two torches, intuition and reason, which I thought is a really interesting and very significant ways. How do you search for the soul? Well, intuition and reason.
Yeah.
If we follow this mystery. So it's bringing that to this process of reclaiming the lost soul.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. The, you know, we talked about this a bit earlier before the show, but it was interesting how these, you know, these mysteries are of course divided into two main parts: the lesser mysteries, which have to do with the Persephone mythology and the sort of ascent of soul into the underworld, and then the greater mysteries, which have to do with really the freeing of the soul from the underworld, in essence. So it's, one is, you know, soul coming into matter, and one is, you know, the greater one is matter coming, being freed, excuse me, soul being freed from matter. So that both are necessary in the development of, you know, towards enlightenment, towards understanding and wisdom. But, you know, they're two different stages on that path, which is very interesting. By the way, I wanted to recommend, really quickly in here, a nice mythology book that I use often. It's called Murray's Manual of Mythology. M-U-R-R-A-Y, Murray's Manual of Mythology. And it is in the public domain. I think you can find it on sacredtext.org or on Google Books or whatever the PDF, wherever the PDF books are found, or you can get cheap copies of it on Amazon. But it's a great book to have when you're studying Manly Hall's work, because if there's a god or goddess or a concept or so forth that you don't understand, you can quickly go to that book and kind of get a real good background on it. So I just wanted to make that point. So one thing too that he brought up, which I found really interesting, was that these mysteries really, and all of these secret schools are connected. I'm just going to read this quote because I like it. I like it very much. It's from page 67. And Manly Hall says, "There is every reason to believe that all so-called secret schools of the ancient world were branches of one philosophic tree, which, with its roots in heaven and its branches on earth, is, like the spirit in man, an invisible but ever-present cause of the objectified vehicle that gave it expression. The mysteries were the channels through which this one philosophic light was disseminated." So I think that's what's important. One of the important things about looking at this Eleusinian mystery school and how that it influences the different philosophical schools that come after it and so on, is that really it's just a continuation of this universal wisdom coming down to us as human beings through these different religious and mythological and symbolic groups and movements that we study and that are still alive today. I mean, this wisdom is still alive. It can be found. It can still be studied. It can be found within. It can be found within the groups that exist today, even because it's universal and it's timeless and it's eternal. And so that's something to remember too, is to look behind all of these different religions and these different ideas to find the universal truths and the universal messages. And I think that's something that Manly Hall tries to make clear throughout the secret teachings, is they're not disconnected. They're all connected, and you've got to look deeper in order to find the truth beneath the sort of multiplicity, the unity beneath the multiplicity. Would you agree with that?
I agree, and it's not to defend the multiplicity so much, but these particular schools and sects arise in particular times at particular places. So you could even say that maybe one could arise again today. You could have a new mystery school that has technology involved. I mean, look at the movie The Matrix. But that covers this same origin, this original tree of wisdom that we need. Sometimes we need these truths, these universal truths, to be cloaked or dressed in a way that we can understand for our time, for where we are in our culture and development, that's relevant to our time. Sure. And place, even though underneath it, it's very, very much, drawn from the same thing. It's like a well that you can dip into, and you could water this crop or that crop or yourself or wash, or, you do all these things. Yeah. With it. But it has an original source and an original purpose that, I believe throughout time, has been maintained and been reproduced. But it is good to know that underneath it all. And I think as, Manly Hall is laying out, he's giving a lot of details and a lot of specific information about this myth or that one. And at the same time, he's also laying the case that they are similar in principle and also even in the purpose.
Exactly.
And yeah. That they might, bring the value, what they serve for us. So it's both. It's both this, but I think, again, the thing to keep in mind is try not to get too caught up in this one versus that one, when they're actually, more of the same.
No, it's
then different. And we have the lens of history. Sure. We can look back and say, oh gosh, there's millions of these mystery schools. Well, they were localized in a particular place and time when they were thriving, and they probably didn't have that, you know, historical context, you know, that we have now. So they were relevant and important unto themselves.
Yes, yes. No, that's a good point. And I think I'm reminded of Joseph Campbell talking about Adolf Bastian's idea of, you know, the localized version of a myth and then the universal version of a myth. And he had two great German terms, which were multisyllabic. And I cannot remember. The Germans have such great terms for everything with, you know, those.
Was it Weltanschauung?
No, it's something like, that's the like worldview. This is, it's something like the Folkengesteigen or something. My German is non-existent. One is the sort of folk view and the sort of localized version of mythology. And then the one was sort of a universalized or archetypal version of the myth. They're both interrelated and they both have the same ultimate meaning, but you know, it's as if the archetypal plays itself out in different ways amongst different cultures at different times and places in history and so on. And I think that's an interesting, you know, tie into what you were saying. One thing I wanted to bring up, the last thing before we move on to those second parts, or those other two parts, the other mystery schools, is this sort of encapsulated belief that Manly Hall speaks about of the Eleusinian belief sort of overall, what they were striving for in essence. And he said, the crux of the Eleusinian argument was that man is neither better nor wiser after death than during life. If he does not rise above ignorance during his sojourn here, man goes at death into eternity to wander about forever making the same mistakes he made here. And of course, I'm reminded of Hinduism, Buddhism, Gnosticism, whereby, you know, one's efforts are very important in freeing oneself from ignorance or delusion in order to move to higher levels of spiritual understanding. And I think sometimes in the modern world, especially in the sort of Christian world, we have an idea whereby faith is the sort of only important thing. Belief is the only important thing to in terms of salvation. And that's a very sort of modern view in Christianity. I think in earlier iterations of Christianity and the earlier Christian groups, there was much more emphasis on works. And James himself speaks about in the Bible about faith and works. So it's important to remember that both are necessary. We need to work for our own salvation, but at the same time, we do need to have faith in God or, you know, the powers within or the gods within or however you want to look at it. And know that there is something higher that is helping us. But also we need to, you know, put feet to that. We need to put work into, you know, into our own understanding. And again, that gets back to what we were talking about at the very beginning of the episode, why we're studying this material in the first place, to become better people, to live better lives, to free ourselves from delusions, to hopefully help others do the same, right? So I think all that stuff is important in looking at that. So since we don't have a ton of time, we're going to get into these other parts. We'll get into the Orphic mysteries. Let's talk a little bit about that. Why don't you take that, since you are the musician and Orpheus, of course, is the founder of music and so on. I hand it over to you. So let's talk Orpheus.
Okay. Well, the myth of Orpheus and his lover Eurydice is a great tragedy in the Greek mythological pantheon. It's familiar to some, Hymns of Orpheus by Thomas Taylor. There's, Orphic, even in the movie Titanic, there was a scene where the string quartet is playing on the deck as it's starting to sink. And the band leader says, that was a song. I forget the title, but it had Orpheus in the title. This tragedy starts out in some ways very similar to the way it was with Ceres and Persephone. Eurydice actually was bitten by a poisonous snake and was taken to the underworld after that. It wasn't like the world. Earth opened up and she fell in, but it's still similar in a way that, you know, goes down to the underworld. And then Orpheus has to go down and get her. And the symbolism in this myth having to do with those two as a couple, they represent skill on behalf of Orpheus, brilliantly skilled musician, could play anything. And Eurydice symbolizes the heart, that the soul feeling in music, because otherwise you're just a technician that'll play scales all day. And that may wow a few people. It doesn't really do much for your heart. There's no soul in this music. It's just some chords and notes. And that after she was taken away from him, his music was never the same. He was never able to do that because he lost the beauty in the music. So we need this technical skill, but we also need, you know, the larger reasons, the beauty or the purpose or the gift that we're doing these technical things, that it has to touch the heart in some ways. And it can't just be this. Otherwise, it's just kind of a material exercise. So being skilled as a musician, he was able to get past the three-headed dog, Cerberus, by playing music. This motif comes up a lot, and there's different ways to, you can put them to sleep, you can bribe them, you know, there's different ways to get around this three-headed dog as the gatekeeper to the underworld. But he goes down, and Persephone's there. And so when Orpheus, you know, then bargains with Pluto and Hades, and you know, Persephone actually plays a role, and they make a bargain. They say, okay, you can have her, you can take her back up to the upper world, because he realized the lengths that Orpheus was willing to go through to risk his own soul to recapture her. But the deal was, as you're ascending to the earth plane from the underworld, don't look back, was the admonition. Don't turn around and check your progress, make sure she's still there. And when the end was in sight, he did turn around and look at her and barely got a glimpse of her as she got sucked back into the underworld. And I know there's a Bob Dylan record called Don't Look Back, and it documented the same title. So, you know, that may, Boston had a song, mm-hmm, Don't Look mm-hmm. Back. You know, I believe, anyway, I haven't talked to these people or read in an interview, but I believe that that's related
to
this.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Just don't look back, because it's so, you know, strong in the myth of music. And of course, you know, to finish this tale up, when Orpheus, he made it out alive, but his soul was dead. She wasn't there anymore. And his music, although maybe it impressed some people, it didn't inspire him. And it gets even more tragic after that.
Yep.
He winds up on an island, and some, you know, other characters come in and I think behead him at some point.
Yes, yeah, exactly. It's interesting, though, because I think it ties into, Manly Hall has a nice quote with this. And I think this is one of those mythological stories that represent those human beings, excuse me, that are willing to suffer, you know, for the sort of forward movement of man, in essence. And Manly Hall puts it this way. He says, Orpheus is one of the many immortals who have sacrificed themselves that mankind might have the wisdom of the gods. You know, and you see this played out later on in tales of living and dying gods and other mythologies, and those sorts of that sort of symbolic idea is captured in a lot of histories and stories. It's, of course, in the stories of Jesus as well. So there is that kind of suffering and love and sacrifice that goes on so that we may live a better life as human beings in the whole. Another one of the interesting things that he points out is that Orpheus was considered in Greece the founder of theology, the institutor of morals, the first of the prophets, prince of poets, of course, the muse of musicians in general, or the teacher of musicians in general. And he taught the Greeks the sacred rites and mysteries. And in addition, was also the founder of Greek mythology. So a very, very important figure in the mythological understanding of the Greeks, of the ancient Greeks. So unfortunately, we don't have a huge amount of time, and you did a very good job encapsulating that mythology and talking about that. Thank you. So the last one we're going to talk about, very briefly, is the Bacchic and Dionysiac rites, Bacchus and Dionysus. Dionysus, of course, the son of Zeus and Semele. Dionysus essentially was, he was staring into a mirror. There's a mythology. It's rather involved mythology. I need to read it. But he stared into a mirror and sort of found himself, sort of like the Narcissus story. And then at this point, he was torn apart by Titans or the other gods. And they boiled and roasted him. And then Pallas, also known as Athena, rescued the heart of Dionysus. And he was able to be resurrected. One's reminded of Osiris and Isis.
Yes.
And at that point, Jupiter destroys the Titans, and then the Titans actually form humanity, the basis for humanity. So it's a beautiful myth, and it's very important. So you'll read that around page 76 in the reader's version of the book. The thing that really blew me away was where Manly Hall points out that Dionysus represents the unity among the diversity. It's the unifying, sort of unified, the unified consciousness behind the diversity and multiplicity, which is life. Found that very interesting. And it's very analogous to the idea of the Buddha consciousness or Christ consciousness. And those figures really mythologically in a lot of ways are related. Buddha, Christ, Dionysus, Bacchus. Bacchus, of course, the Roman name, and Dionysus, the Greek name. And he brings up another point again about the heart. And of course, Jesus, Buddha, and Dionysus are all known as sort of heart-based or faith-oriented type figures. The ancients said that man does not know the gods by logic or reason, but rather by realizing the presence of the gods within himself. And in essence, I think Dionysus represents that God within man. It's one of the very, very, very early mythological ideas of God within man. So I found that to be interesting. Did you? What did you pull out of this portion of it that stuck out for you?
Well, that it's a process of integration. This, just as in, you know, with the Orphic and Eleusinian, that, you know, the heart or the soul gets separated from the body. This is actually even more fragmented, that it has been dispersed and separated from this unified, you know, more spiritual, more divine origin. And that is the again, like you said, like, Isis and Osiris, you know, going out and collecting all the pieces of the body to reconstruct the God, that this is something that we do with ourselves, that it is when we can integrate all these fragments that, you know, little pieces of us get, well, I had to give a little piece at work and a little piece there. And, oh, that was a childhood dream, but I had to let that go. You know, they're there, they're still hanging around, but we're disconnected from them. And it's by bringing them together that it's a very integrated act of pulling these parts together, that once you do, you return back to this unified field with all the pieces in place. So I got a very this either disentangled, but then just to bring this separateness back to a unified presence, and then there is wholeness.
That's great. Yeah,
you know, holistic healing. It's a wholeness.
I'm reminded. I'm reminded of the idea of the self as the organizing principle in the Jungian psychology, and then the different parts of oneself that are sort of fragmented that need to be brought under control of the self with a capital S, and that sort of mediating influence is the ego that does that. But I think that fragment idea is a very powerful, very powerful one.
And it relates to like this last chapter
or last paragraph rather of this chapter, where they're talking about the Dionysian artificers,
the
architects of you know, that, and that, and, you know, relating it to, you know, what would become Freemasonry, that, you know, again, that's building, you're constructing something. You need a true cornerstone, you need a firm foundation, you need, you know, true walls, and you have to have a well-placed keystone, you know, all these, you know, stone building things. Again, you're bringing these things together, that you're constructing a whole that's greater than all
these. They say in Freemasonry, you know, building better men. That's the goal of Freemasonry in general. And they,
that's the allegory.
They use the, you know, they use that allegory of actually a building of stones and shaping rough stones into smooth ones and so on. And I think that's a really fantastic allegory. Let me read that last paragraph, because it is it's very cool, and it has a lot of neat stuff in it. So let me go ahead and just read it out. It's on page 78. The Dionysiac architects constituted an ancient secret society in principles and doctrines much like the modern Freemasonic order. They were an organization of builders bound together by their secret knowledge of the relationship between the earthly and the divine science of architectonics. They were supposedly employed by King Solomon in the building of his temple, although they were not Jews, nor did they worship the God of the Jews, being followers of Bacchus and Dionysus. The Dionysiac architects erected many of the great monuments of antiquity. They possessed a secret language and a system of marking their stones. They had annual convocations and sacred feasts. The exact nature of their doctrines is unknown. It is believed that Khairam Abif was an initiate of this society. Khairam Abif is, of course, a mythological figure in Freemasonry. That's really a neat paragraph, and pregnant with a lot of symbolic meaning. I enjoy it very much. And I think that's one of the neat things about this book, is there's just so much to dig into. So,
well, that brings up something that actually loops it back to the beginning of our talk today, that the architect, in this sense, they're working in the mundane world with the rocks and the stones and all these things. It's not a removal to some Valhalla or some higher, you know, monastery on the mountain peak. They're actually working on the earth with earth things, but they're divinely guided in their workings with. So, you know, I know with spiritual practice, you know, sometimes in extreme senses, and you think, well, it's just, I'm going to remove myself from the world. That's the profane, and I'm going to be off in this spiritual world. As long as you're inhabited in a body living on earth, chances are you're going to have to do some earthly things. You know, but they're going to be guided by this divine architect, you know, this master builder that is moving you and animating your choices and informing and inspiring those things. But it's not, even the upper and the lower worlds aren't that separate. There is a connection with the superior and inferior, the sacred and mundane, a greater and lesser, upper and lower. You definitely want to make this move towards higher and higher, but in a building, you can't really build a penthouse. You don't build that without having a basement.
No, for sure.
Lobby and a mezzanine and first, you know, floors. It's a building upon, but there is a guidance.
Architect. And I like that metaphor that he used, that image of the, that we talked about at the beginning when I read a bit. Manly Hall talks about a tree with its roots in heaven and its branches reaching out to the earth, you know, and that's really that connection. That's that cosmic tree. That's the connection between heaven and earth. And really that's what humanity is that connection.
We're in that, I guess, liminal state. We're part earth,
part divine,
and we are part divine. And it's our job to manage both of
those.
That's
a great way to put it. Worlds. That's a great way to put it. And that's, you know, that's a nice place to leave off. It's, you know, that's really the crux of this work is finding that, that balance within ourselves between the earthly and the divine, and to wrestle with those issues and to, you know, use this philosophy to become better people you know, and have faith that there is a higher force that can help out, and pray and meditate and find your way through this life, and just keep studying this material. And I just want to encourage everyone to keep moving forward, even if you're discouraged, you're frustrated, you're depressed, or if, you know, if everything's going great. Either way, you can always lean on your higher source. You can lean on these teachings and this wisdom, and it will not disappoint, you know? So do you have any final parting words for our listeners?
Well, this material has certainly been helpful for me to find meaning and sometimes strength in difficult, when I get wrapped up in the world, worldly things, and the spiritual things seem so far away, and where is God, and what's going on here? But to lean on these ancients and all these traditions and, you know, beautiful mystery schools that, you know, era after era, century after century, and all these cultures that they're really trying to keep the same flame alive. And I want to dip my candle in that flame, and then I can have my own local light to help guide me through. And it's easy to get caught up in this, you know, the word hell, etymologically, in some viewpoints, has to do with being walled in, that you're trapped, you know. And so it's sometimes we can feel trapped in our lives, and it's, you know, it's actually very easy to do. And it takes a little extra work to involve yourself with these mystery schools and teachings and traditions. And there is that leap of faith that there is a divine hand guiding things. And if I can tune in with that, my meanderings through this world will be easier. I'll be able to do more with it, and I'll be able to recapture my soul that sometimes gets buried in the stuff of life.
Well put, my friend. Well put. And that was Chris Sheridan. He is the author of The Spirit in the Sky. I am your host co-host here, Jason Napolitano. And the show you have been listening to is Cosmic Eye, and we're looking at Manly Hall's Secret Teachings, Ancient Mysteries and Secret Societies. That was the last part of that. Next week, we're going to do Atlantis and the Gods of Antiquity, which is part five of the book. And that should be a fun one. So do tune in for that. And like I said, please check us out on anchor.fm under the Cosmic Eye Show, and call in with your questions if you'd like to interact with us, or you have something you'd like to hear us talk about, and let us know. And do check out chrissheridan.com or cosmiceye.com to hit up either Chris or I if you want to get us through there through email and so on. So thank you for listening to the show, and please join us next week, and have a great week. Goodbye, and God bless.
Thank you for listening, and please join us next Sunday for a new episode of Cosmic Eye. You can purchase If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate at Amazon.com or through our website, cosmiceye.org.